John, good show this week because we get one of our favorite guys to talk to, whether at the ballpark or on our podcast, and that's David Cone.
Absolutely. There's a reason he's been on multiple times. He's a fantastic talker and was an incredible pitcher for the Mets and the Yankees. I'm anxious to ask him about all sorts of things, Mets, Yankees, MLB, analytics. It's going to be outstanding.
Hey, he was an outstanding pitcher. We might even ask him about the Hall of Fame. John and I will talk a lot about the Los Angeles Dodgers, the team that everyone is gunning for this season. We'll play hit and error at the end if you stick with us on the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You know, John, what has hit me recently is it's been a great time for kind of Kansas City Royals owners, right? They signed their star player, Bobby Witt, for a long-term contract. What was it, $288.7 million, maybe even more than that if all his options kick in. And the guy who owns 1% of the team just won his third Super Bowl. That's Patrick Mahomes, whose dad obviously has been on the show, was a relief pitcher for a long time. You and I were texting each other during the game because we had to do this stupid podcast, right? This is what we're worried about while a Super Bowl goes to overtime. But John, it's hard to ignore. We're in baseball season now once the Super Bowl ends. But what'd you think of the game?
I mean, Patrick Mahomes is an all-time great. I'm not a football expert. I got this game right, which breaks a streak of many, many years of being wrong. But it seems like you just got to go with Mahomes when you have a chance. Go with Brady when you have a chance. Go with Montana. It's easy to say that in retrospect. But I think Tony Romo said it right. He's like Michael Jordan. When it comes down to it, he always ends up winning, especially when he's the underdog. He seems to have a chip on his shoulder. It's amazing. It's great to have a dynasty in football, and it's great that it's in a small town like Kansas City. And, of course, you're right. They made baseball news this winter with some free agent signings, as well as Bobby Witt Jr., and we're going to have David Cone on, who's from Kansas City. So it's the real Kansas City theme today.
It's a Casey kind of thing. Yeah, John, it's I almost wondered as the 49ers were coming down in overtime and they settled for the field goal. I think it was like fourth and four. I was like, you're going to give Mahomes the ball. You better score a touchdown. You go for it. like there's, you know what he feels like? He feels, you mentioned Jordan, he feels inevitable. Like this was not a team that, like, you know, he didn't really have a number one wide receiver. They had young tackles. Like, this was felt like a step back year for them. And if I were to make a tough transition to kind of where we're heading here in our opening segment, last year was supposed to be like a step back year a little bit for the Dodgers, right? They cut payroll. They talked about going like with younger players than they did, and they still won 100 games. They have won 100 games in every season for the last 4 years that have been 162-game season, and only in the one that was the short season, the 2020 season, did they win the championship. They have clearly built themselves into the super team this year by $1 billion-plus offseason, mainly built around Ohtani and Yamamoto. John, I've been in their camp for about 4 or 5 straight days in Arizona. John, what do you think of this super team?
Yeah, I mean, the Chiefs are definitely a dynasty. I mean, in baseball, we only count dynasty as a team that wins a bunch of World Series in a short period of time, like the Yankees did of the late 90s, early 2000s. And it's just that it's so difficult to do it in baseball. I mean, we have to give the Yankees team even more credit than we did at that time. It's basically impossible. You don't win with just one or two great players like you can in basketball. And even in football, if you have an all-time great player and you surround him with very, very good players, obviously Kelce is a great player and Chris Jones too, but I mean, you can win with a great, great quarterback. That's not the nature of baseball. You have to wait your turn to bat, and the game's not played on paper. Anybody can win. I know they say it's a crapshoot. I'm not sure it's quite a crapshoot in the playoffs, but in effect, the Dodgers, even though they've only won one World Series since 1988, in effect, they're sort of a kind of baseball dynasty. If you win 100 games basically every year, you win your division every year except for one, a year in which you won 106 games over the last decade plus. In effect, that is kind of a dynasty. I mean, they are, in my mind, I don't know what the odds makers say, they are the clear World Series favorite, but you know, anything can happen in baseball. It certainly will be fun to watch this super team. We've had some pretty darn good teams in the past, but I don't know if we've seen one this star-studded with Betts is going to be a Hall of Famer, Freeman a Hall of Famer, obviously Otani's a Hall of Famer, Kershaw now Hall of Famer, Yamamoto, they paid him like a Hall of Famer. So, I mean, you're not going to be able to take your eyes off this team. Whether they win the World Series, can't guarantee it, can't even absolutely confidently predict it to this point, but in effect, it's a dynasty and it's a team you're not going to be able to take your eyes off.
Yeah, I think I'm different from you, John, and I understand the difficulty of winning a championship. And I agree with you. With every year that passes where nobody even doubles up, retrospectively, what the Yankees did from 96 to, I include 2001, when they got to Game 7 of the World Series, like that was special. I'm not sure it's ever repeatable again with as many rounds of playoffs as we have, as we go through. You know, this feels very much, I'll ask you a question. Do you consider kind of the Bobby Cox, Maddox, Smoltz, Glavine Braves, were they a dynasty? They won once, what was it, 14 years in a row or 50, something like that. They won a division.
14.
Because the Dodgers, who've made the playoffs 11 straight years, have won the division 10 of those. I think in the year they didn't, they won 106 games or 100, and I think the Giants won 107. Do you think of those Braves as a dynasty?
Well, I'm taking it out here. They're certainly a National League dynasty. I would say they're some sort of dynasty. I mean, I'm not going to compare them to the Yankees teams because the World Series wins stand apart rather than just making the World Series. But I count them as a dynasty, and I think we're going to see a dynasty. And I kind of think the Dodgers are kind of in the middle of a dynasty, too. You win 100 games or average 100 wins for, you know, it's going to be a decade once this thing keeps going. I think that's a dynasty, but I think their fans are going to be dissatisfied if they don't win multiple World Series with Otani and Yamamoto.
Yeah, you know, John, I it's something I learned covering the Yankees. First, when I was on the beat, and they were mainly a terrible team when I was on the beat in the late 80s and early 90s, I think when you're in that situation, you look for reasons why a bad team might win. And then when they became a dynasty, I always was covered them and thinking, what would keep them from being a champion? And so as I've been around the Dodgers for 4 or 5 days now, and I look at it, obviously, without major injury, their offense is going to be outrageous. You mentioned, you know, Betts, Freeman, and Otani batting 15 times every day is kind of like ludicrous to a level. If I were looking for something, and they solved this last year because they had a lot of starting pitching issues, but still, their starting pitching right now is Glasnow, career high 120 innings. Yamamoto, used to pitching once a week, never pitched here. James Paxton, who, you know, hasn't gotten through a full season since 2019. And two kids, you know, in Miller and Sheehan, who are talented, but kids who haven't pitched a full season. And even the guys who are behind them. Kershaw not till probably July or August. Walker Buehler probably not till like May, coming off of Tommy John surgery. Dustin May maybe not until the second half of the season. If I were looking for a reason they weren't going to win, and I think they'll overcome it because they overcame it last year. You know, Kershaw got her Urias, off the field stuff, et cetera. But that would be the reason.
Yeah, I mean, I throw Tony Gonsolin in there, too, who's got a
He's going to miss the whole year, though.
He's not going to miss the whole year. He had Tommy John, though, last year, right?
So, yeah, but
all right. Well, I mean, May, Buehler, Kershaw, I mean, these are exceptionally talented pitchers. Obviously, Kershaw, an all-time great. I don't see a reason. I like what they've done. I don't mind that they don't have pitchers who are going to throw 180 innings. They have kids and guys who've had limited innings in the past and multiple injuries in the past in many cases. I mean, they've got so many of them that they can throw at you. They're not going to need 200 innings from Paxton, which they won't get, or any of these other guys, or Glasnow. To me, this is the best team that we've seen on paper since probably those Yankee teams. It's hard for me to name something. Obviously, you can pick it apart and say they could get a little more production. I wonder about Gavin Lux still here and there. But I mean, the top of the lineup is crazy good, all-time great good. And the pitching talent is amazing. I mean, we thought they had injuries last year in their pitching, and their pitching was in the top two or three in baseball even last year. And now they've added Yamamoto. And people could talk about the adjustment to the ball, or the adjustment to anything. I mean, he hasn't pitched at all at the major league level. I mean, I got a feel that all these teams can't be wrong, right? I mean, many teams offered $300 million plus, right? The Yankees did as well. I think there were others that offered $300 million. The Mets did. I mean, this guy is going to be a star. I mean, we talked about this with Senga in spring training last year, and he was the best thing about the team last year. He was their best player. I mean, obviously Lindor and Alonso were really good, but Senga was their best player. So the Japanese pitchers, we can talk about the adjustment. They make the adjustment, and he's going to be a big star. And this team is vastly improved from a 100-win team. So I'm to answer your question, I really don't have a good answer for it. I don't see it. I think this team is a 110-win team. I don't know what the odds makers say, but I'm taking the over.
Look, I'm with you. The Japanese ace who has come over, Darvish, Tanaka, Senga, etc., they've all pitched towards the top of the rotation. So I have very little doubt that this pitcher is. One of the things with Senga, remember, he only pitched on standard 4 days rest 3 times last year. So the Dodgers will kind of, they're very smart. Obviously, they'll figure out. I do think on the field, if I were kind of like listening while I've been here, what concerns them a little bit, Lux coming back from the knee injury. I wouldn't be surprised if you said, Joel, bet on something that happens during the season at the trade deadline. Willy Adames, maybe from Milwaukee, if Milwaukee's not in it. Tommy Edman from St. Louis, if St. Louis isn't in it, to maybe help at shortstop in case this doesn't go right. John, why don't we end this segment? We're talking about the Dodgers. The biggest thing they obviously did was Ohtani. 10 years, $700 million, the well over 90% of it is deferred. I wrote a column about this where I kind of just thought about what would it mean for his offense if he isn't preparing all season to be a pitcher also. I mean, in 133 games last year, he hit 45-ish homers. He had over 1,000 OPS. He stole 20 bases. He hit 8 triples. And by the way, he didn't have Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman hitting in front of him, getting on base 40% of the time to make sure he has to get pitched to a lot and see fastballs because those guys could run. What do you think is possible for Shohei Ohtani offensively?
Yeah, I mean, he had Trout and Rendon, but they were hurt a lot. So, I mean, he's not going to have that issue here. He
Well, the
presumably will
problem was
bat
Rendon
second.
wasn't. Rendon hit fourth a lot for him. The problem was Rendon hit fourth a lot for him. He was terrible protecting.
Right. Now, as Dave Roberts said, you would think it sets up with Betts one, Ohtani two, Freeman three. Do we know that
I
that's
think
clearly?
I kind of have gotten the feel again, they are
Yeah.
being squirrely about a little. I think it's going to be Betts, Freeman, Ohtani. I think they're going to
Okay,
go
and then you'll have
Betts
Will Smith.
back.
You'll have Smith batting behind him, right?
Smith, yeah, Muncy, maybe against lefties, maybe Teoscar Hernandez would hit a little
Right.
fourth.
So they got three candidates for the cleanup spot.
Yeah.
I mean,
All better than
being with being
Rendon.
in this team, and I'd heard early on he didn't want to go to San Francisco because of the ballpark, which I think they have trouble getting other guys too. So I'm not pitting this on him or anything like that, but it's a tough park for a lefty to hit unless you're Barry Bonds and you have help and whatever, and he doesn't. So I mean, he's in a park, another park that plays straight up. He's surrounded by superstars. He's clearly, he's concentrating on Hitting, who knows what he could do? I mean, he could hit 60 home runs. He is a freak. In many ways, the most talented guy that we have ever seen. I'm not putting anything past him. And I think they're just going to be fun to watch. And I personally think, and I know I've gotten grief from Toronto people, it's good that he's in LA because we're going to see it more. And not only that, the people in Tokyo are going to see it more too because the games are on, and night games are on at 8 a.m. there. If it was in Toronto, they'd be on at 5 a.m. So I think it was a positive that he went to the Dodgers. A positive for everybody, but the poor Angels who still haven't replaced him.
Yeah, John, that's not a minor thing. Look, let the fans in on a little something. I think Yamamoto delayed time of day he wanted to talk to reporters that, when he talked to us so that it would be daytime in Tokyo. Like, it's not a minor consideration for those players as we go along. The one thing I'll say about Ohtani is, and Andrew Friedman talked about this, and I was thinking about it even before I spoke to the president of baseball operations of the Dodgers. Watch the stolen base numbers where he doesn't have to kind of protect his legs, think about the strength of his legs for pitching. He stole 20 bases last year as designated hitter. I think 40-40 could be in play. I think an Acuña kind of season where he kind of like does like, a lot of steals, a lot of homers are in play for him. It's one of the fascinating things. We are now in baseball season, right? I'm in Arizona. You're going to St. Lucie. And if you stick with us, we'll be talking to one of the best in the game at breaking it down. That's David Cohn. If you stick with us on the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman. John and I are so happy to have someone we really have appreciated having in the past, David Cohn, the terrific announcer. Yes, ESPN Sunday Night Baseball. David, thank you for joining us. Look, you're going to be in the Yes booth again. Yankees were pretty busy this offseason. So why don't I just start there? Is they did a lot. They didn't do everything they had hoped, right? They had hoped to pull down Yamamoto along with Soto. But they did get Stroman. They got a lot more left-handed. They probably got better defensively in the outfield with better depth. What do you think of this offseason for the Yankees?
Well, I really believe that if it's hard to fathom, but I think their moves are underrated in a certain sense. Juan Soto is that good. So when you put Juan Soto in pinstripes for the full year, both home and road, I think he's going to match up well at Yankee Stadium. And then you get Aaron Judge healthy for the entire year. That combination offensively is a real game changer for the Yankees. I think their pitching is certainly they're a little short in terms of overall depth. And we're going to find out about their farm system. We're going to find out about their young pitching. Guys like Will Warren and company are going to get a shot this year. So they're going to really rely on some of their young arms to fill in the depth areas of their pitching.
David, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on and thank you for not getting upset when I started texting you. I forgot it was during the Super Bowl. Most people would not be happy to get texts about something like this during the Super Bowl. And you are from Kansas City, so congratulations on your Chiefs win. So I really interrupted something important for you, but I want to take this opportunity, first of all, ask about Yamamoto. 325 million. People are saying, well, he never pitched at the major league level. That's the main thought about the record contract, which is 1 million more than Cole. The other criticism is that he's a 5'10" right-hander. Now, you're a little bit taller than 5'10", but you're not a big guy. What do you think about the idea of giving $325 million, first of all, to a 5'10" right-hander, and second of all, to a guy who's never thrown one pitch in the major leagues?
Those are all valid points, and we're all anxious to watch him pitch to see how he adjusts. And there will be an adjustment. Just the baseballs themselves are slightly smaller in Japan. They're tackier. So every pitcher that comes over from Japan sort of has that adjustment with the Major League Baseball, and it's slicker, it's bigger. They've got to get used to it. It leads to some arm injuries that we've seen in the past as well. But I think Yamamoto, when you're talking about mechanics, the fact that he's 5'10" makes his mechanics more simple in my mind from an old school standpoint. That the guys that were 6'6", 6'7", the Randy Johnson types, even taller, had trouble sort of harnessing their mechanics. I think I've watched Yamamoto pitch. His mechanics are top shelf. Very simple delivery, very repeatable. I think he's going to be outstanding. The proof's in the pudding. We'll see how he reacts to major league hitters for the first time. But once again, in today's game, we have so many more ways to measure, scout these players with data-driven technology. It's not just some old scout sitting in the stand saying, I think this guy can do it. He has a plus fastball and a plus slider. No, we've got spin rates. We've got approach angles. We've got just about every kind of data point you want to evaluate the type of stuff coming out of his hand, and it all matches up. And that's part of the reason why he got that big contract.
I'm here to tell you, John and David, I talked to him in the clubhouse yesterday. If he's 5'10", which is what I am, I'm in the NBA. Okay, so he ain't 5'10". Let me and clearly the pitch tracking stuff was central to what the Dodgers did. I talked to a bunch of their officials, and you know, the ability to look at a pitch and say this ball moves like this guy in the major leagues or has this velocity, this shape, was part of it. Let me ask a bigger question about the Dodgers that you're almost the perfect person, probably the perfect person to answer. It's reminded me a lot of the Yankee dynasty years where they've built up to be the super team, obviously without the championships. They have the one in 2020 during the pandemic year, but you know the Yankees. One year it was the Roger Clemens of Japan in Arabu. The next year it was actually Roger Clemens and Knobloch and then Giambi and A-Rod and Randy Johnson, and it kind of built this thing. What do you think about the kind of super team in general and the pressure that comes with being the 29-1 team when everyone's coming after you?
Yeah, no, there's no doubt there's pressure there. I talked to Dave Roberts about it. I know he understands, historically speaking, where they fit in and what they're trying to do there, especially with some of the seasons they've had, you know, with the tremendous regular season success and not being able to close the deal. And all I can tell you is this, is comparing those Yankees of the 90s, those teams, with the Atlanta Braves of the 90s. The Atlanta Braves were similar to the Dodgers in that regard, where they were the juggernaut. They were the super team, supposedly. But it comes down to pitching. You've got to match up. You got to have a number one guy. You got to have a number two guy that's a number one guy. You have to have a number three guy that's a number one guy. And that's what we had with the Yankees. Everybody took turns being the number one guy. One year, Andy Pettitte was the four starter. The next year, he was the first starter. Interchangeable parts in the rotation. Orlando Duque Hernandez. I think that's the one thing that the Dodgers have missed, is that shutdown starter. And then it gets back to Kershaw and Kershaw's kind of problems in the postseason for whatever reason. It's a crapshoot. I get it. And he's a Hall of Famer, surefire. But in postseason, they haven't had somebody to back him up. If your number one starter falters, okay, who's your second number one starter? And that's the problem in postseason play. You know, we were able to match up with Maddox and Glavin and Smoltz with our rotation. That's where the Dodgers have lacked in postseason play, in my opinion.
Got to ask you about Carlos Rodon. I mean, you're from Kansas City, as I mentioned. You adapted to New York almost too well. You were great in both locales, in Queens and in the Bronx. Do you think it could be a New York thing with Rodon, or was he hurt? What's your theory of what happened to him last year?
I think he really got behind the eight ball when he was hurt right out of spring training. And, you know, I think he's a sensitive guy, too. He's highly emotional. He pitches with a lot of emotion. And when guys like that get behind the eight ball with their injuries, and then they get out into the first couple of starts of their season, it's already half over. The season's already half over. Then you struggle, and then the things snowballed on him. And the emotions got the better of him. Physically, he wasn't the same. And also, there's a difference between being sort of this redundant style pitcher. I'm just going to throw high fastballs and low sliders, and I'm going to throw that those two pitches over and over and over again. You don't have a plan B to go to. You need a plan B if that doesn't work. You know, it's great if you're throwing 97 miles an hour and you've got your A stuff, your A game stuff. Then that two-pitch redundant style can work. But if you don't, what's plan B? Do you have a changeup? Do you have different looks? Do you have any mystery involved in your repertoire? And to me, that's what he probably needs to work on, is that plan B. Because when 97 isn't there at the letters, and also when hitters are adjusting to that more and more every year, because we've seen that style work over the last 5 or 10 years, that high fastball over and over again strategy, it's starting to get caught up to by hitters around the league. And I think that's something that he should probably take note of.
You mentioned plan B. The Yankees' plan A clearly was getting Juan Soto this offseason. The lefty diversity, the lefty excellence. We've gotten a little over 8 minutes into this without actually talking about those two words, Juan Soto. David, what did you think of the trade giving up all that pitching depth? And what do you think is he does in a when he's just in this walk year and he's a very unlikely sign? This is a walk year player.
It's a walk year player. Obviously, the Yankees need to sign him long term. We'll see how that goes on down the road. But they do get to see him for a year first. They get to see him in pinstripes to see how he plays, to see how he reacts. That's not a small thing. It's not the easiest place to play for a lot of players. I'm sure Juan Soto will not have a problem. But as far as his impact on the Yankees lineup and what they gave up, position players are hard to find. Batters are hard to find. Bats are hard to find nowadays. There's a real premium on bats. Arms are easier to find in comparison. It seems like the pitchers are a little ahead of the curve with technology of learning new grips and learning new pitches, whether it's a sweeper or, you know, a different shape on their pitches. Pitch design is ahead of the curve right now. So finding pitching is a little bit easier than position players. And the Yankees didn't have to give up their top prospects in terms of position players. Any of their young outfielders, name one. They have a couple of great young prospects that are outfielders that they didn't have to give up. So to me, that's somewhat of a win, although Michael King looks like a game changer. If he's healthy, he looks like a guy who could really make some noise in the rotation with his stuff and his repertoire.
You know, the Yankees are favored in the AL East. The Orioles won last year by 19, or beat the Yankees out by 19 games. They're a younger team. They got Corbin Burns. If you believe that they are the favorite, try to convince me why the Yankees should be favored, because I frankly don't get it.
Well, everybody's in the predictive business now, right? I mean, that's what all of these metrics are for. Whether it's Zips or whoever you want to go to that's an expert in predicting the future. The Yankees are predicted by a lot of these projections to win in the mid 90s. And I think it's based on Soto for a full year, Judge for a full year, and a bounce back from Stanton in the middle of that order. So certainly you can plug in Alex Verdugo and put his above average numbers on his career into the mix as well. Maybe Anthony Volpe takes another step this year. So the lineup has to get better. It will be better. And the lineup was the problem last year. So if you're factoring in, a better offensive output overall this year based on Juan Soto and Aaron Judge back-to-back, two top five hitters, then you can see where the projections are there. I think we all know, though, that pitching is really a key in terms of overall depth. And I always say every year that's not your top five starters. It's your next five starters. Who's 6 through 10? And when you look at the Yankees, there's some names on there you probably never heard of. And we're going to find out about the kids. I mentioned it before, but it bears repeating. The young arms in the Yankee rotation, you're going to get to know these guys. You're going to have to get to know them because you need at least 8, 9, 10 starters before the season's over, really before the halfway mark. Usually that happens.
Yeah, and look, they traded a lot of that pitching depth to get Soto. So some of those guys whose names we weren't real familiar with last year, like Brito and Vasquez, are gone, and the Warrens, the Beaters, etc., are going to have to come up and be them this year. The guy who's pulling all those strings, David, is Brian Cashman, who clearly took a lot of criticism through last year, through the offseason. He's kind of always on the griddle now. The team, like for the Yankees, not winning since 2009, you feel like you have to carbon date it now. It's been so long. You span an interesting period. You were a player when he was an assistant GM and then the GM of the Yankees, and you've covered it. Is Brian Cashman still an elite general manager?
Well, Brian Cashman will be the first one to tell you that what he does the best is hire people around him. And he's created these processes around him, where he's built up the analytics department. He's built up every department, even the pro scouting department led by Tim Nehring. He's not the guy that will do a lot of vetoing. It's like, this is the way I want it done. This is a decision I want to have made. He really trusts the process, and he'll run it through the washing machine and it'll come out with an answer. And he generally will go that direction and trust his lieutenant, so to speak. So, you know, if there's some criticism there, you know, maybe he needs to be a little more forceful and have that veto power and be a little more forceful with the decision making. Just from the outside looking in, you know, I don't have any inside information with regards to that opinion. That's just my opinion. But is he an elite general manager? I think if you look around the league and his contemporaries, they think he is. They talk about him almost with reverence, universally, really. You go down the line of any general manager or any front office type that's been around for the last decade or so, or even longer, they love talking to Brian. He's a straight shooter. You know what you're going to get with him. He's well-respected. I think the question with the Yankees is the overall decision-making, this revisionist history that's easy to live. Why didn't you call Bryce Harper? Why did you do this move? Why weren't you in on this guy? I mean, the list goes on and on and on about players they could have had. Why wasn't Manny Machado brought to New York to play third base? Or, you know, what about why wasn't Seager looked at, a left-handed power hitter that's a shortstop when you needed a shortstop? You decided to wait on the rookies. I mean, this revisionist history is something that's always going to be talked about among the Yankees fan base. And, you know, I'm sure Brian Cashman would have an answer every step of the way of what their thinking was, what their process was, and why they chose what they did. But nonetheless, the Yankee fan base sees Bryce Harper, you know, taking Philly to the postseason, and it hurts because he was a Yankee fan. He was a Mickey Mantle guy. He wanted to be a Yankee. So, you know, that's what you have to contend with if you're Brian Cashman, the revisionist history part.
Yeah, I want to ask you about one of the more recent decisions. Talk a lot about the shortish or not tall, at least right-handers, Marcus Stroman. He decided to go with Marcus Stroman, and it does seem like, at least not for now, they're laying off of Blake Snell. What do you think about Marcus Stroman generally, and are you surprised about what's going on with Snell? Here we are. I'm heading up to the Mets camp today, and he's one of many stars, but the biggest star, really, not to have a job at this point.
I am somewhat surprised about Snell. I think, you know, part of the problem with Blake Snell is sort of the workload issues, which everybody knows about, the sometimes control issues, the high strikeout, high walkout rate combination, the five inning pitcher kind of a thing. That's probably the red flag for a lot of organizations, even though his stuff is impeccable. His stuff is off the charts. It always has been. He's really got some of the best stuff you'll see. I mean, the ride on his fastball, the high velocity action on his fastball, the biting breaking stuff, the good changeup. I mean, he's got the full repertoire. He would be perfect in any rotation. The problem is long-term and workload. And that's what you hear over and over. So yeah, somewhat surprising, but then I understand, you know, the arguments against. I still think he's going to end up in a good spot somewhere, you know, and really help somebody out. But yeah, I am a little surprised. Stroman, on the other hand, I think the Yankees got a good deal on Marcus Stroman. He's highly motivated, highly emotional. He'll thrive in New York. He loves the spotlight, keeps the ball down, keeps the ball on the ground. Good fit for Yankee Stadium. I mean, there's a lot of pluses with Marcus Stroman. Local kid, big personality. He'll bring some life. He'll bring some life to that clubhouse and some life to that team. I'm a fan of Stroman, although I know he's rubbed some people the wrong way wherever he's been at certain times. So, you know, he certainly is a very sensitive guy, but he's also a tough kid. And I think that's an interesting match for the Yankees, especially when they really need a starting pitcher. He was the guy right there for them.
David, in a lot of ways, I think you're the emblem of how baseball people should think, right? When you played, I thought of you as like kind of a baseball player gamer, like, give me the ball. I'm not going to talk about injuries. Whatever I have, you're going to get. You were certainly brighter than the average guy who was in a clubhouse. But I thought of you as a baseball player. As an announcer, it's clear that you've drifted towards understanding the analytic stuff and being able to make it conversant to the average fan. I can't believe in 2024 we're still having this fight about, like, what is best. I wonder if you could talk about the marriage and how it would work best, because I think you embody both things.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I people are still, you know, having that analytics are ruining the game. And then you ask them, well, what does analytics mean to you? And nobody has a straight answer. You know, which part of analytics do you have a problem with? Do you have a problem with the high-speed cameras that are measuring the spin rate for pitchers that they're using to not only measure their spin rate, but also the vertical and horizontal movement on the break of their pitches, and refining that and having tremendous success with it. And something that I wish I would have had when I was pitching, I would have been all over that sort of thing in terms of, boy, if I drop down here, if I change my arm angle and change my grip, that the break is like this and the hitters don't like it and the success rate is going to go off the charts, then those are the things in analytics that are really good that have helped pitchers a lot. Now, if you're talking about sabermetrics within the realm of, under the umbrella of analytics, and you're talking about whether you should sacrifice bunt or not with nobody out and a man on first and second, then yeah, that's an argument we can still have. You know, there's a lot of variables involved. Can the pitcher field his position? Who's playing third base? How fast is the runner? Can he bunt? You know, there's a lot of Buck Showalter things in there that guys like him think about that analytics doesn't cover. You know, analytics can be, strategy, style of play, three-run home run, Earl Weaver style. I mean, we think this is new. It's not. Earl Weaver played that style back in the 80s, which just don't run, don't get caught stealing, just wait around for the three-run home run. Well, that's nothing new. But, you know, if you're the guy that thinks that analytics are ruining the game, then you don't really understand analytics. You know, in my mind, you haven't taken the time to educate yourself. There are areas you can push back on, but you better understand it first. You better dive into it and understand, you know, which part you have a problem with, as opposed to just laying that blanket. I can't stand the game today because analytics has ruined the game.
You know, we're 20 minutes in, and so we're hitting overtime here at this point. We haven't mentioned your career, which was quite fabulous. And I'm actually one of, I don't want to say few, but one of the people who voted for you for the Hall of Fame. Obviously, you didn't make it. I think when I told you I voted for you, you told me I was wrong. I don't know. Maybe you were kidding. I'm not sure. I mean, you won 5 World Series. It was a lot to your career. Overcame an aneurysm. Perfect game. I mean, I think, well, you 19-3 one year. A ton of strikeouts. I'm about impact. Do you really think I was wrong that you're not a Hall of Famer? And, you know, we always ask all the, I don't want to say old timers, but guys who played in the past, who they think we've missed on as a Hall of Famer, besides yourself. Who did we blow it with? Who should be in the Hall of Fame, who's not?
Well, on the pitching side, in my generation, I think it's pretty well defined who the best were. I thank you for the Hall of Fame vote. I would have liked to have stayed on the ballot a few years and have a conversation about where you fit in.
Maybe that's a bad rule. That's a bad rule.
We're going to have the Joel Sherman rule, right? Everyone's got to stay on the ballot 3 years.
Yeah, I think that would have helped because it's hard to tell your story in 1 year. It's hard because the writers have a tough job. They've only got so many spots they can vote for. There's a few guys in my generation, you know, that I think about. You know, Kevin Brown had a really good career, actually a higher WAR ranking than I had. There was a point there when he went to the Dodgers where he was just dominant, and with the Padres too as well. He was one of those guys where hitters would come back to the bench, and I judge by the hitter's reaction, what my team's hitters said about the opposing pitcher, and they hated facing him. His stuff was just filthy. The movement, the sinker, the heaviness. He threw bowling balls out there. So that's certainly one guy. But when I think about my generation, I think about, you know, I predominantly pitched in the 90s, the decade of the 90s, maybe the back end of the 1980s, 88 and on. Pedro Martinez came in after me, but he's still considered part of my generation. But I think about, Randy Johnson, Pedro, and then, of course, the Atlanta guys, because they came early and they stayed late. They had, you know, they finished on a much stronger note. Maddox never went on the injured reserve list. Over 500 games started. I think 700 games started, I believe. I think it was an incredible, ridiculous number. Glavin the same way. Smoltz, those three guys, obviously very deserving. Smoltz the closer and the starter. So to me, that's, you know, and Clemens is in there too, even though I know that the PEDs and, you know, all the speculation around him is probably going to keep him out, or certainly has hurt him. But yeah, Roger Clemens might be the greatest pitcher of all time when you just from the numbers standpoint. It's Pedro, it's Randy, it's the Atlanta guys, you know, and then beyond that, you know, you get into relievers. But yeah, I think the conversation could be had because we understand pitchers more now. We can peel back the layers and look at who really did what. and look at the numbers a little differently than we used to, as opposed to just wins or just ERA. I think there's a lot better ways to try to gauge on what a pitcher really did when he was on the field.
You know, David, John stole my thunder a little. I was going to close with a Hall of Fame question and a bit of a mea culpa, which was, I didn't vote for you. And now each year, as it feels to me, a standard gets a little lower for who I see voting. I'm like, well, I thought you were 1.5. Like, I vote for 1%. And I thought David Cohn was 1.5. But in this standard, I think you might be a Hall of Famer. And I think what people miss is you just talked about what Kevin Brown felt like to your hitters. I'll say what it felt like in the press box, which was the Yankee-Red Sox thing was as vicious as confrontation, you know, kind of thing. It's like, if you were on the mound, I felt you were a one. I felt they were in trouble, kind of thing as I thought about it. And John used the word impact. I thought you were a one for 10 years. So I'm not, you know, I keep evolving. Like, people say, why do votes change over time? Like, you know, like you talked about bringing analytics into your thinking. Like, I don't know. I keep thinking things in a different way. So that didn't lead to a question. So let me, because John got to my question about the Hall of Fame, we have ignored your old team in New York, the Mets. Let me just ask, we'll finish by doing this. You're an observer of the game, obviously, ESPN. I think you'll probably do one of the London games this year, Phillies and the Mets, right? What do you think of their offseason? Where do you think they're at? Sorry for being so around there.
I'm glad you came around. Yeah, you were wrong, Joe.
Yeah, by the way, I'm good at mea culpas. I'm wrong a lot.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the sentiment, certainly. And we all like talking about ourselves, right? So, I could do that with anybody as well. But as far as the Mets go, it feels like they have pivoted on the dime, right? When they pulled the plug and made the trades last year and then kind of have shown some restraint, although I'm sure they would have taken Yamamoto if he would have wanted to be a Met. I'm sure he would have anteed up for that. But it feels like, you know, Steve Cohen's going to learn a little different lesson here and say, you know what, I'm going to trust my lieutenants. I've got, you know, a GM that I really trust now. I'm going to give him a little slack on the leash and see how we can build this thing from the ground up. And that's what every organization dreams of. It's hard to do it from the top down. He tried to do it from the top down the first 3 years or so when he was the owner of the Mets. Now he's going to go the other way and go from the ground up. And that's probably a good thing. You know, let the young guys play, you know, get those kids in there, get them at bats. And I think over especially the last year and a half, Buck Showalter was a little reluctant to trust the young guys. He's always been that way. He wants guys to prove themselves. You know, Buck Showalter's old school in that you have to earn your way. You know, he's not just going to throw a rookie in there and trust him. And I'll give you an example of that. Back in 1995, Tony Fernandez was the Yankee shortstop, and he had a bereavement case where he was out of the lineup, and the Yankees called up a kid named Derek Jeter to play shortstop that day in Milwaukee. Derek Jeter was 2-for-2 that day and made a couple of great plays defensively. Tony Fernandez showed up in the middle of the game, and it was boom, boom, right into the game. Derek Jeter, you come sit down, and we were all going, leave that kid in a little. I want to see that kid Derek Jeter play a little bit more, but you know, that's how, and I admire Buck for that. He really understands that, hey, you have to earn your keep. You have to earn your way. You have to prove that you're respectful of the game. You have to prove that you can be a big league player and handle yourself the right way. He still believes in that. But I think it's time to let the kids play in Queens and find out what you have and build it from the ground up. And I believe that's where they are now.
I think the problem with Buck that year was he didn't let the kid Mariano Rivera keep pitching in October. You might have won that very, very famous Seattle series if he did. David Cohn, we always appreciate when you join us on the show. We always appreciate seeing you at the ballpark. It always makes us smarter. And in this case, I know the fans like it also. Yes, ESPN, David Cohn, thank you so much for joining the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman.
My pleasure, guys. Anytime.
John and I thank David Cohn for joining us on the show. John, hit or error as we begin spring training.
I know we've had a lot of Dodger talk, but I'm going to give the Dodgers a hit for bringing back Clayton Kershaw. I think it's a move that they needed to do. He's a legacy type player, an all-time great, maybe the greatest pitcher of certainly of this generation, maybe of the last 50 years. You'll have a case for Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, Greg Maddux. I'm sure there may be one or two others I'm not thinking of, Roger Clemens, but he needs to be a Dodger. He's coming back for 17th and probably his 18th seasons. In L.A., certainly wants to get that 3,000 strikeout. He will do that. And good for Mark Walter and the Dodgers for bringing him back.
You know, John, I'm actually here. That was going to be my hit.
Oh,
is
okay,
the Dodgers. So
sorry.
I'm maybe where of a different generation. I understand players' rights. I'm all for it. I like the idea of the career-long player, somebody who spends their whole career someplace where they're totally identifiable. So I'll just ad lib and pivot on for a hit on the thing, which is I like baseball's back. John, we've done this for a long time, both of us. Lots of spring trainings, if you combine us or individual. It's, you know, I've been at the ballpark because the Dodgers and Padres are opening in Korea on March 20th and 21st. Their camps opened early. I was at the Padres yesterday. I was also at the Dodgers yesterday. I've been at the Dodgers 4 or 5 days. I mean, I still like going out to the ballpark. I still like talking to people in and around baseball. It's Super Bowl's over. It's good to be back.
Yeah, I love spring training. I can tell you about my first spring training, which might be even before your first spring training. I don't know. It was Palm Springs, the Angels. I think it was 87.
Yeah. See, when you get old, you can't even remember in the 80s.
I know. They won't want me to be president. I can't remember anything. 1987. First thing I remember was day one. I was flown out, these days we were allowed to do this. I don't think it's kosher today on Gene Autry's plane. So, you know, obviously you're flying on his plane. You've got a little bit of a conflict of interest there. But I remember I didn't know the rules. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. And Butch Weiniger, the catcher for the Angels, one of the catchers, was warming up Donnie Moore at the time. It was a relief pitcher. I think we remember gave up the big home run to Dave Henderson. Of course, the Angels have shot at their first World Series win. And he had done that in 1986. So this was, I think, the next year, next spring, 1987. So he probably wasn't in a good mood to begin with, but he's warming him up. And I'm actually trying to interview Weiniger as he's catching him. And that's not something that you should be doing. That's clearly not right. Mm-hmm. I remember Donnie Moore, my first day there, he starts, cursing me and telling me to get the heck out of the, and use the word heck, the heck out of there. That was my remembrance of the first spring training. As we know, Donnie Moore had quite a temper, and I was really testing him there. How stupid am I, though? I thought I could interview the catcher while he's warming up the pitcher.
Yes. I'm not going to argue with you. You are stupid. And just look, I think we're in a time now, since we're on YouTube, which we would have never guessed then. Gene Autry, famous country singer who owned the Angels for a really, really long time. So I guess we should say who he is. John, you know, look, we're off and running here. The shows from now on will be, we're both be fully in spring training. You know, we thank so much our producers, Andrew Hartz, Dan Shalom. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong, Dan. I'm sorry, even with your help. I mentioned YouTube. Don't forget to watch us on there. Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, please rate, review, listen to us. The reviews do help. And John, I think we'll both be in Florida to do a show next week. Probably you in St. Lucie-ish and me in Tampa. But spring training's off and running. Super Bowl's over. We're ready for baseball. Stick with us on the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman.